This evening we are reading from Matthew chapter 22, and we're starting at verse 15 and going to verse 40. So that's Matthew chapter 22, starting at verse 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his talk. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away. The same day, Sadducees came to him, who say that there is no resurrection. And they asked him a question, saying, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, and having no children, left his wife to his brother. So too the second and third, down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her." But Jesus answered them, "You are wrong, because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not God of the dead, but of the living." And when the crowd heard it, they were astonished at his teaching. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets."
And let me share with you a little bit of local London knowledge. This is not the sort of local London knowledge that's actually that useful, because everyone knows it. Just down the road in this direction is the Old Bailey. On top of the Old Bailey is Lady Justice, a statue of the Greek goddess Themis holding a sword, the Sword of Justice, and the scales. It's a very famous part of the London skyline. And the scales there are to depict weighing each case in that criminal court. Even if we've never seen the inside of a courtroom, I guess we're familiar with it from TV dramas and films, aren't we? The case for the prosecution and the defence laid in front of the jury. And then the sentence, the verdict cast and the sentence passed. And I guess we'll also have seen those cases, for most of us probably just on TV, where the case for the prosecution is so overwhelming, all of the evidence is pointing in that direction. As it's weighed in the balance, it's not hard to see which direction it's going. And when that happens, the only thing left to the defense team is to turn on the prosecution, to try and undermine the witness, to invalidate their case. I'm no legal expert, but I've seen enough real crime dramas to at least get the idea that that's what you would need to do. Well, we're back in the courtroom as we continue our series in Matthew this week. And Matthew 19 to 23 has been playing out a little bit like a courtroom drama as Jesus builds the case against first century Israel. They have failed God. They deserve his judgment, as we've been seeing. But this week, Matthew recalls the dramatic development as the religious leaders who have been bearing the brunt of Jesus' accusations, they turn their fire on him. They try to undermine his witness, to invalidate his case. We saw glimpses of it back in chapter 21, a while ago now. But here in this passage, it comes thick and fast as question after question is fired in Jesus' direction, in an attempt to try and discredit him and knock him down. In fact, rather than picturing ourselves in the Old Bailey in that direction, let me suggest that instead we go a short distance in that direction to our local boxing ring. Yeah, you see, you didn't realize I was a keen boxer, did you? Now you know why Mickey is really running away scared to Australia. Did you notice when he sat down earlier how he moved slightly away from me? No, obviously, I'm clearly not a boxer. But I know enough about boxing to at least conceive of this passage as three boxing rounds, three attempts from the religious leaders to knock Jesus out. And although their punches might seem a little odd, their questions might come across as a bit niche, I've been struck by how contemporary this passage is. Haven't we all experienced Jesus in the firing line? As he passes judgment on the world, as he draws attention to its failure, the world turns to attack him. Whether it's directed at us in our college or our office, as friends and colleagues demand that we defend his teaching, or more in the public sphere, as celebrity atheists list their reasons for dismissing Jesus and everything he stands for. And however familiar we are with such arguments, I guess we'll all have had moments when we feel the vulnerability of their attack, when something in their question causes us to pause, when it seems maybe they've got a legitimate objection. Are we really on the right side? Perhaps worried that we'll end up looking like idiots. And maybe you're not a Christian. You're looking in on the claims of Jesus. And maybe the arguments of celebrity atheists or the people you know are the very reason why you don't want to throw your weight behind Jesus. Why you're anxious about taking his side. Well, Matthew has recalled these ancient episodes, this argument between Jesus and the religious heavyweights of his day, to give his readers confidence that Jesus is the right person to get behind. Even as Jesus is put in the firing line, even as he's attacked with questions that actually turn out to be quite contemporary, Jesus has an answer for every one of them. So whether you're a Christian or someone who's looking in, it's my prayer this passage will give all of us greater confidence to follow Jesus wholeheartedly. It's worth saying these episodes will be quite familiar to lots of us. Mark 12 records these same events, and I'm aware some of us are actually studying that part of Mark at the moment. However, the authors, Mark and Matthew, are doing slightly different things, and we need to hold them slightly separately. So if you've got a Bible study in Mark 12 this week, don't start thinking that this is going to be a cheat on your preparation for that study. Hold them separate, because we're going to need to focus in on what Matthew is doing if we're going to hear his particular emphasis. And to help us do that, let me suggest a question to have at the back of your mind as we go through this whole talk. In each round of this boxing match, who is winning? Who is winning? You can probably guess where I'm going to go, can't you? Let's start with round one, and let me read from verse 15 again. Verse 15, then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his talk. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully. And you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? The Pharisees and the Herodians, they are what one commentator has called strange bedfellows. The Pharisees, They were a group committed to religious rules and regulations, some of which they'd gathered from the Old Testament law and plenty of which they had added to that. They weren't part of the temple priesthood, but they were sufficiently religious that they would have been conceived of those who really cared about God and his will. And then on the other hand, the Herodians, the supporters of King Herod, and implicitly then supporters of the Roman state under which he ruled. In lots of people's eyes, that would have been tantamount to making them enemies of God, just as the Roman authorities were seen as opposing gods. And when you see where they're coming from, you can see why this question turns out to be such a test. So dangerous, in fact, to try and answer. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? He could take the side of the Herodians. Yeah, it's lawful. But in doing so, he would take Rome's side and make enemies of all his religious supporters. Or instead, he could take the side of the Pharisees. No, you shouldn't pay the tax. And he says what pleases his religious audience, but then he opens himself up to the charge of treason. Do you let the state call the shots? Or are you one of these God-botherers? Do you pledge complete allegiance to the crown? Or are you a religious nut? That's the choice that Jesus is presented with. Either you take the state's side over God and lose all claim to be religious, or you take God's side over the state and get labeled as a treasonous troublemaker. Wonder if you've ever been set a challenge like that. And maybe that's a legitimate question. Is following Jesus about being a troublemaker? Or is it in fact just appeasing people? You can picture the glee on their faces as they suggest that. Teacher, we know that you're true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you don't care about anyone's opinion, for you're not swayed by appearances. Doesn't sound like there's even a small amount of sincerity in that point, does it? You don't really care about anyone's opinion, do you, Jesus? You're happy to make enemies? Well, try this one for size. Who are you loyal to? It's hard to understate the significance of Jesus's answer. Did you notice that as it was being read? This is an extraordinary answer. Have a look at verse 18. Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." Do you see what Jesus has done there? Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. It's a clear affirmation of the authority of the state, isn't it? It's as though he's saying, you already recognize the authority of the state by using their coins. You know they carry jurisdiction here. I've got something here that the oldies might recognize, a little illustration for us. Some of you might be old enough to realize what this is. This is a coin. You used to use it to exchange for services and goods. You come and ask me about it later. But on one side, it's got a picture of Her Majesty the Queen. And by using her, I implicitly recognize that she and her government carry some sort of authority here. As with the rest of the New Testament, Jesus here is affirming the authority of the state, even the God-hating, God-opposing state of Rome. But at the same time, he relativizes it. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. What has God's likeness and inscription? It's us, isn't it? Humankind made in his likeness. Whose likeness and inscription is this? It's God's. And that's not me getting above myself thinking I'm all that. It's the very first chapter of the Bible that tells us God made all of us in his image. And so the state is due our taxes, but God is due our all. It's a statement with extraordinary significance, weighing heavily into our understanding of the relationship between the authority of God and the authority of the state, how we understand culture. We're not anarchists, but neither are we atheists. We do acknowledge the authority, the rule of secular authorities, even those who hate God. But we also acknowledge the greater and supreme rule of God, to whom we owe our all. It's a hugely significant statement, and we could spend the whole of the rest of our time just exploring that. But it's worth seeing why Matthew has put this episode here. It's to expose Jesus' opponents, isn't it? It's to show that they're not trying to find out the truth. They're trying to catch Jesus out. As Jesus says in verse 18, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites?" And moreover, he's setting them an implicit challenge. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Have you paid up your debts to the state? Have you paid up your debts to God? If we've been paying any attention to the teaching of Jesus so far, we'll know that the answer to those questions is no. They were not those earnestly searching for truth, but those who are opposing God. Get to the end of round one, and the question is, verse 22, left him and went away. Now, they may not have been knocked out by Jesus' return blow, but they feel its force. It's not hard to work out who you'd award that round to, is it? Who is winning? Round one to Jesus. So what about round two? What I've called, "You don't really believe that, do you?" Let me read from verse 23. Verse 23. The same day, Sadducees came to Jesus, who say that there is no resurrection. And they asked him a question, saying, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, having no children, left his wife to his brother. So to the second and the third, down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her." That last bit's not there, but you know what I mean. The Sadducees, verse 23, they say that there is no resurrection. Acts 23, you can read later, tells us that they added angels and spirits to the list of things that they did not believe in. In fact, John Stott, in his book, "But I Say to You," it used to be called "Christ the Controversialist," he's really helpful at saying that they're basically the equivalent of scientific materialists in the modern day. Are those who go the supernatural, resurrection, angels? Nah, not for me, thanks, no chance. If the Pharisees were so obsessed with the scriptures that they added to them, well, the Sadducees were so skeptical about them that they took away from them. In fact, they were only really willing to accept the first five books of the Bible at the Pentateuch. And they think that they've got a challenge that can humiliate Jesus. The bit of the Bible they accepted, the Pentateuch, it included a command that if a woman, if someone died, then his brother had to marry the widow in order to ensure that the family line of the deceased could still continue. It was an institution called levirate marriage. But the Sadducees, they're using this as an argument against resurrection. They say, if this woman ends up with seven husbands, how's the resurrection going to work? It's just going to get really messy in this resurrection idea that you've got. It doesn't sound plausible. Therefore, the resurrection must not be true. You don't really believe in it, do you? So they're not just dismissing the supernatural, are they? They're also using one bit of the Bible to try and contradict another. They're a bit like those church leaders or Bible scholars who take one verse and try and use it to exclude another one. Again, it's not hard to see ways that Jesus still meets those kind of opponents, is it? Have you ever found yourself in that position yourself, having to defend the supernatural? Do you really believe that? Or perhaps to reconcile two Bible verses, are you really saying that both of these are true? And perhaps they've got a legitimate question you start to wonder. Are we really right to follow Jesus? Well, Jesus' answer is as biting as it is ingenious. Just have a look at verse 29. But Jesus answered them, "You are wrong because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God." Can you imagine getting that answer from your RML Bible study leader? It's really great afterwards to be able to talk about the sermon. I'd love when I meet you to be able to talk about what we've been hearing God say here. But please, if you want to give me some crit, can you put it a bit more gently than this? Of course, Jesus reserves this sort of exasperation for these religious leaders, those who should have known better and who set themselves against him. This certainly isn't a model for our normal interaction for each other, but it is a brilliantly crafted answer for that audience. First, you don't know the power of God, verse 30. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. The Sadducees' conundrum just ignores how powerful God is. Jesus doesn't elaborate on what he means by like angels in heaven, but it's clear that the resurrection life that God is offering is something beyond our current experience. Trying to exclude the possibility of resurrection life by squashing it into earthly categories, well, it's obviously wrong. God is way above that. And so the scientific materialist needs to be silent. You are wrong because you don't know the power of God. And then secondly, you don't know the scriptures. Verse 31, and as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not God of the dead, but of the living. And now I would have made the case from one of those passages that makes it really explicit that there is a resurrection to come. Something like Isaiah 26, maybe Daniel 12, Ezekiel 37, you can go and check them out later. There's plenty of bits in the Bible that make it really clear there is a resurrection. But Jesus chooses the very scriptures that they claim for themselves, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. They'd abandoned lots of it, but they were happy with those books. And so Jesus selects a bit from Exodus, to be specific, Exodus 3. And he says, haven't you thought through the implications of this bit of Exodus 3? The logic is a little bit complicated, so feel free to ask me about this when you come and tell me I'm wrong because I don't know the scriptures or the power of God. He's not just obsessing about the verb there, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because Exodus 3 verse 6 doesn't actually have that verb there. He's not obsessing about the tense of the verb, I am the God of Abraham. But in the context of Exodus 3, God is nonetheless identifying himself with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, three guys who by that point had died. If God is, as Jesus says, not God of the dead, but of the living, it would be strange for God to identify himself with three dead guys. But if God is a resurrecting God, a God who will bring those three men back to life, well, then it makes complete sense to keep identifying with them. He's still got business with them. He's still got a covenant to keep with them. And they're going to be resurrected. To put it simply, if God is still connecting himself with three guys who have died, well, it should have awakened the Sadducees to the idea that God is a resurrecting God. Don't worry too much if you haven't followed that. In fact, you can check out Isaiah 26 or Daniel 12, because I take it you might think that actually that's a part of the Bible you want to listen to. And it's very clear, God is a resurrecting God. And the crowd were happy with Jesus' answer, weren't they? Verse 33, when the crowd heard it, they were astonished at his teaching. They're persuaded by what he says. They're astonished at it. The Sadducees' attempt to silence Jesus has turned back on them. Their punch has fallen short, and they are floored by the return blow. You are wrong because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. They're left exposed, aren't they? They are not those who are earnestly searching for truth, but those who are opposing God. And as we come back to our question, who is winning? Well, who are you going to give round two to? I think we can give it to Jesus again, can't we? So what about round three? Are you genuinely moral? Let me read from verse 34. But when the Pharisees heard that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. This is the episode that is most different from Mark's account. And I think some of us today, Mark, are looking at this episode this week. Sorry, it's really quite different, as you'll discover when you read Mark. Focus in on Matthew. But for Matthew, it's still a test, isn't it? Verse 35, one of them, a lawyer, asked Jesus a question to test him. And for the lawyer there, don't think about lawyers here in the city. This is a Pharisee who evidently knew the Old Testament law inside out. And his question is to challenge Jesus' credentials. Do you know your stuff? Are you genuinely moral? But since it comes from a Pharisee, I think it goes further than that. Think about the Pharisees in the rest of this book of Matthew, if you've been with us through this series or read the book before. They are the ones who have constantly been adding to the rules of the Old Testament law, and they'd lost all sense of what was most important. Back in chapter 15, verse 1, they said, why do your disciples break with the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat. Or in chapter 12, verse 2, they said, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath, even though there was nothing in the Sabbath laws that they were breaking. In fact, in a couple of weeks, in chapter 23, we'll hear that they are tithing, that is, giving a tenth of their mint and dill and cumin. Which I have to say, if you try to weigh spices, it's really difficult to do, especially on old ancient weighing scales. But they've decided to focus on that instead of the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. They've lost all sense of what's important. And so they're not asking Jesus to find out really what God cares about, but to see if Jesus conforms to their standard of morality, which is the great commandment. It's not an earnest inquiry of Jesus, is it? But a challenge to assess whether he fits with their view of what's moral. Are you genuinely moral? And if that is right, I'm not sure, but if that is the right way of understanding their question, doesn't that feel deeply contemporary? Whether it is from the left or the right, we have built up an extensive moral criteria to which we're supposed to conform. Are you sufficiently woke, sufficiently green, sufficiently permissive, sufficiently progressive? Or are you sufficiently patriotic, sufficiently pro-business, sufficiently morally outraged by the way that society is declining? The list of things that are demanded of Jesus in order for him to prove his moral credentials, it's increasingly extensive. And maybe we're persuaded by some of that. Yeah, that seems right. Maybe that is what Jesus should be like if he's supposed to be genuinely moral. Are we right to follow Jesus? Well, Jesus shows us what the great commandment truly is. Verse 37. Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. However much you might sport your virtue and your piety, there is a core to morality upon which everything else hangs. Everything that the law and the prophets commanded depends on love of God and neighbor. Not that love is a test of scripture, as though we can use it to see if something really belongs there. Love is a test of us to see if we're being truly obedient. Remove love of God and neighbor, and our obedience is useless. Remove love of God and neighbor, and you may as well have done none of the rest. And in fact, it's a core to morality that produces, well, beautiful morality, doesn't it? I think about the horrific headlines that you have most recently heard, and imagine a world in which we genuinely, all of us, loved God with all of our heart and mind and soul. Imagine a world where all of us loved our neighbors as ourselves. How much would your life be easier if you and everybody in it did exactly what these two commandments said? It produces beautiful morality. But of course, like all of the other answers that Jesus has given this week, it exposes his hearers because they haven't loved God with all their heart and soul and mind, and they haven't loved their neighbor as themselves. As chapter 3 is going to put it, you tithe mint and dill and cumin, somehow's not there, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. As we saw earlier in this section, they failed to give God the fruit that he is due. Once again, Jesus' answer exposes them. And so we come to the end of round 3. And we ask that same question, who is winning? Who is winning? It's got to be Jesus, hasn't it? The religious leaders have been left utterly flawed. They're not wise, they're wrong. They're not strong, they're weak. They're not experts, they're exposed. And with them, so are all of the modern equivalents. As we've seen all the way through, the questions of Jesus' opponents, well, they are questions that Jesus still gets leveled against him today. In fact, 200 years ago, when the Bishop J.C. Ryle was writing on these verses, he's always good for a quote, he said this, absurd skeptical objections to Bible truths are ancient things. Absurd skeptical objections to Bible truths are ancient things. That's right, isn't it? They are not the innovations of modern wisdom, the progressive advance of the intelligent, but the tactics of those who opposed Jesus 2,000 years ago. Modernists are anything but. The words may have changed, but the sentiment hasn't. We as Christians may be called obsolete and old-fashioned, but that's being done by those who are using 2,000-year-old tactics. And Jesus' exposure of them then works to expose their counterparts today. They are not earnest investigators, but vicious opponents. Not truth lovers, but God haters. And doesn't that help you in the moment when the world puts Jesus and his teaching in the firing line? Modern culture tends to herald such opponents as wise philosophers, enlightened, illuminating. And certainly there are some people who are asking earnest questions of the Lord Jesus. This is not ruling out the idea of asking questions. It might be you are here because you want to ask questions. And as Mickey mentioned earlier, we've got a whole week designed for people who want to ask questions, genuine questions, to find out the truth about Jesus. But these questions of these opponents, they're not the questions of real research, but of opposition to the truth. And we need to call them out as the spiritual equivalent of the Flat Earth Society. Do you know there was a Flat Earth Society? You might have heard about this, a group who still maintain that the world is flat, in spite of all of the evidence. Their social media account apparently once said, we've got members from across the globe. Unfortunately, that's probably apocryphal, but it makes the point, doesn't it? We don't think of flat earthers as intelligent, rational searchers for the truth. Not truth lovers, but truth haters. We want to say you are wrong because you know neither the planet you live on nor the pictures of its round shape. And that's Jesus' response to these guys here. You are wrong because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. Those who are set out to test him, to entangle him in his words, to them, Jesus pulls no punches. He wants us to dismiss them alongside the flat earthers. And yet our focus as we close shouldn't be left on them. Rather, we need to see Jesus' vindication in these verses. In every challenge that is put to him, he comes out the other side victorious. In every argument that is leveled against him, he answers. In every round, he wins. How do you think Jesus feels when a celebrity launches into another dismissal of Christianity, or when another book gets published claiming to put the final nail in his coffin? Ooh, no, someone's gone after me. Obviously not. As our final song is going to put it, though the nations rage, kingdoms rise and fall, there is still one king reigning over all. Here is the king who triumphs over his opponents, the one who's exposed his enemies and who resists every counterattack that comes his way. In fact, every counterattack only exhibits his greatness further. Did you spot that as we were going through? This isn't a passage that just displays Jesus' rhetorical skills, his ability to win an argument. It's one that shows, if we've got eyes to see it, his perfect obedience. Now think about it. Think about those answers that Jesus gives. They cast a shadow over his opponents, but on him they shed a brilliant light. In each and every area where he exposes them, he reveals something beautiful about himself. Because he is the one, the only one, who has given to God what is God's. He is the one, the only one, who knows both the scriptures and the power of God. He is the one, indeed he is the only one, who has loved the Lord his God with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his mind and loved his neighbor as himself. When the objection is leveled against Jesus in your college or your office, as celebrity atheists list their reasons for dismissing Jesus and everything he stands for, are you worried about ending up on the wrong side? Are you worried that in the end you'll be shown up to be an idiot? Whose side do you want to be on? We've taken a trip from the courtroom to the boxing ring this week. At round one, round two, round three. I think they've all gone to Jesus. You can tell me later if you think that's right. Jesus, the victorious one, the vindicated one. But we haven't quite had the knockout blow yet. Don't know if you spotted that. Matthew hasn't quite said yet that they're all silenced. It's coming, but we'll need to see that next week. Let me lead us in a prayer for now. Our Father, how we praise you for our wonderful King, Jesus. Thank you that he is the victorious one, the vindicated one, the perfect one. And I pray that for each and every one of us, you would give us all confidence as we side with him, delight to do so, and eyes to see Jesus' opponents as we should see them, and to see Jesus as we should see him. And we ask it in his name. Amen.